And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very happy to be sitting across the table from a faculty colleague of mine at Carthage College, Dr. Art Sear. And of course, any of you who listen regularly to the morning show know that Professor Sear joins me once a month to offer his analysis of current events both here and abroad. And I can't think of a day when we've had a longer list of really, really important pressing things to talk about than today. So we'll get to all of that very, very quickly. Dr. Sear is director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, and we appreciate him making time for us in a very, very busy schedule to join us for these monthly visits. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. I really look forward to getting together with you, and I don't look forward to everything I have to do. But you're right, we're at the busy end of the semester, and it's always inspiring as well, as all these young people who are moving forward into the world.
Absolutely. Speaking of moving forward, you, I know, sometimes do extensive travel. Is it going to be that kind of a summer for you? Will you be headed to any place exotic and exciting?
I'm going to be spending a little time in Britain, getting some research done. It's the country outside of our own I feel I know the best and I've been able to publish on. There's a conference center called Ditchley Park that has an annual meeting and an annual lecture, and it's always enjoyable to go there, and it's a good way to network, a good way to make contacts, a large number in a short period of time, which is a principal reason for going to these kinds of conferences, along with learning something. So I'm looking forward to it.
Very good. Well, then maybe that's where we need to begin. It's not where I thought we'd begin, but it's actually pretty important, that being the recent elections in Great Britain. And these were results that were in some respects kind of dramatic and confusing, not really quite predictable. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying before we went on the air, Americans, I think, sometimes tend to think of Britain as a relatively staid and predictable, tradition-bound country. And in this particular election, it's not the only one recently, but it's an example of where what was maybe predicted or expected didn't really come true. Remind our listeners, first of all, about what happened in this election and then why it is sort of a striking thing.
The Conservative Party still, although things are changing significantly in Britain, but it is traditionally, and they do have a lot of respect for tradition, a key to their success. The Conservative and Labour parties are the two principal political parties, but long term there's been movement away from those two to other parties. Polls uniformly, and opinion polling is much more a science than it used to be, but still an art, and human behavior is by nature unpredictable, which is why tradition is so important. But to answer your question, there was universal prediction that neither party would get a majority in Parliament, that the trend, modern trend that started in the 2010 election of having to work with a third party to build a majority. We've had a conservative liberal Democrat majority because the Tories needed some more votes, that would continue. But in fact, the Conservatives won a narrow but nonetheless clear majority in the House of Commons, which forms the government. So the pollsters were wrong, and the Tories are busy celebrating nonstop and patting themselves on the back. The leaders of the Labour, as well as Liberal Democrat parties, both resigned, along with a very extreme right-wing party, the UK Independent Party, which did not do well in this election, fortunately, from my point of view. But the polls were wrong, like Harry Truman in 1948, which our listeners, as serious people, will know about. But we know about also because it was such a huge, unexpected victory. There's a lot of that in this election.
Hmm. Maybe you can help us understand those three parties that you just laid out, what they represent, because, of course, it's even in terms of what the labels represent, it's not quite as clear as, for instance, Democrats and Republicans here in the United States. What do those three parties represent? And then what does this fairly decisive victory by the conservatives, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Good question, and an important one. In a nutshell, the Conservatives, as the name implies, are the most traditional party. They are roughly comparable to the Republicans in terms of the fact that higher income voters tend naturally to gravitate to them. Like our Democratic Party, they're great survivors. They've been around forever, at least it seems that way, for several hundred years. There's been a continuous Tory, now more often called Conservative Party. The Labor Party emerged early in the 20th century, significantly and with great speed replaced what had been the main opposition party, the old Liberal Party. Its successor is the modern Liberal Democrats. The Labor Party was based on socialism. Karl Marx was from Germany, but he was really inspired in his important ideas by the conflict in British politics. After working men in the 1880s especially got enfranchised, there was a tremendous growth in support for labor left-wing policies, including formal commitment to socialism, nationalization of industries. And the Labor Party has moved away from that, but its roots remain in that kind of doctrine and that kind of ideology. The two parties we're getting more and more used to intense, highly well-defined, almost ideological conflict between our two parties. That's fairly new for us, but the British traditionally, at least in the 20th century, have had this. As I said, the Labour Party replaced the old Liberal Party. The Liberals survived. I wrote my PhD dissertation 40 years ago on the Liberals in Britain. They've enjoyed a revival. It's been a complicated evolution, including a breakaway element from the Labour Party in the 1980s. But despite the intensity of partisanship in Britain, unlike in this country, they have been a very durable third party. They reject class politics. They reject socialism. They're highly individualistic. When I was a student living in Britain many years ago working on this, I was impressed at how the culture is quite different in Britain. But of the three parties, I felt the Liberals were the most American in outlook and the easiest, especially for an experienced younger American to relate to. It's a very humane culture, a very pro-American culture, and that's important to keep in mind. Another part of the important legacy from World War II, but Britain, the British people, whatever their politics, they see themselves as much closer to us than to the rest of Europe, which is important to keep in mind when trying to understand with clarity their foreign policy.
In regards to the European Union, now with the Conservative Party, with Prime Minister David Cameron, am I remembering that right? Are they positively disposed towards the European Union, or would that be the party of these three that has sort of the deepest reservations about that?
No. The parties have changed and evolved over time, which is essential to a continuous and successful democracy, there or here. Originally, the Labour Party was quite hostile to the European Union, and the Conservatives, starting with Harold Macmillan, very courageously in the early 1960s, initiated the effort to get into Europe, which was an ordeal for them. Since then, the parties have kind of flipped. The Liberals and Liberal Democrats have always been very pro-Europe. The Labour Party, during the Callaghan government in the mid-1970s, had a national referendum, and the people voted by an overwhelming majority to stay within the European Union. Since then, Labour has been pretty consistently committed to Europe. In 1997, Labour came sweeping back into power after some years in the wilderness when Margaret Thatcher and then John Major were the Conservative prime ministers. An awful lot of new Conservatives elected in 1997, the younger generation, were very anti-Europe. And that has been a vexing problem for the establishment leadership of the party. And Cameron has, among other commitments, in a brilliantly run campaign, what one can say is the Monday morning quarterback, you know, looking back, he's committed to another referendum on Europe no later than 2017. I think that was an important element given hostility to Europe in the country as well as in his party to do.
Right. And so depending on what that result turns out to be, then then Britain might face an interesting choice.
Yes, I think it would be a big mistake for them to withdraw from the EU, and I don't think they will. The British politics, like our own, is often full of extremist rhetoric. But when it comes to actual policies, more than us, in my biased opinion, they tend to do the prudent and moderate thing. The UK Independent Party has, from time to time, generated enormous popular support, but they won no MPs in the new parliament, fortunately. From my point of view, they're anti-immigrant. They seem racist. They seem homophobic, very hostile to Europe. They did elect in a separate election for the European Parliament, which all members of the EU participate in. They did elect a notable number of delegates. In fact, they came in second ahead of the Labour Party in those separate elections. The European Parliament doesn't mean much. It was a way for the average Brit to express hostility towards those Europeans. but when it comes to really serious matters, they tend to move back toward the middle. I hope that's clear. It's a subject that's interesting to me, but we academics not only ramble, but sometimes we don't communicate clearly.
Right. No, I think you've laid it out very, very well. Maybe just a quick word about the source of this distrust or this dismissive attitude on the part of many Brits towards Europe. Again, we just blithely look at the globe and just figure that geographical proximity should somehow equal friendship, let alone shared history and so on. What's going on there? What is that rift between the continent of Europe, the Europeans and the Brits? Some Brits.
The term balance of power politics, which we use pretty freely and often with different meanings, its origins are British, going back to Elizabeth I, not the current good queen, but her much more powerful and also good predecessor back in the late 1500s, and to a degree Henry VIII, Elizabeth I's father. The British have been committed to the idea that they should give highest priority to making sure that no continental power dominates the continent. And whether it's Henry and Elizabeth back in the 16th century or Winston Churchill and associates in the terrible times of World War II, that has defined their policy, and I think that's become so embedded. And they have historically, as well as currently, been such an important trading nation, the first globalizers in terms that make sense to us, and in truly global terms, I believe, were the British and their empire. They've tended to look overseas to find not only sustenance, but the power that permitted them to carry out this balancing role in Europe. Mind you, with the value of hindsight, they should have moved much more aggressively toward the European Union than they did. It became very difficult and ultimately embarrassing throughout the 60s. And then finally they were able to stagger into membership after being persecuted by the French under de Gaulle in 73. But I believe that their right to stay in the European Union, they are not in the euro, the common currency. 17 of 27 members of the EU, and maybe 28 members now, but not all members have participated in the common currency. But participating in the market, in cold business terms, when you look at trade trends, not just over the last 100 years, but over the last half century or so, British trade is increasingly heavily involved with Europe, and they run the risk of unprofitable, very damaging economic isolation if they, in fact, withdraw from the EU.
Last question about Britain. You mentioned the fact that Britain and America remain steadfast friends, allies,
yes,
particularly
indeed
in the wake of World War II and the instrumental role which we played in Britain's survival. And on the other hand, when we think about, for instance, Britain and Germany, how much lasting legacy from World War II is still in the air? Is that at all a significant factor? Does the average Brit look with grave suspicion or bitter resentment at Germany, given what Germany did to Britain not all that long ago, in the grand scheme of things? Or generally speaking, is that not a particularly significant factor in whatever tensions might exist today between those two nations?
No, I don't think it's a significant factor. I think the European Union, which was planned with incredible foresight by American leaders as well as some allied European leaders early in World War II, the combination of Jean Monnet on the European side and associates, and starting with FDR and Marshall, the Americans looking to the post-war period, and Eisenhower in a very practical way, as literally bridging the Atlantic as the supreme commander, it's paid off to a remarkable degree. The British, more than we, are backward-looking, and I don't mean that in any offensive sense, but you refer to the importance of tradition. The average person is much feels and talks with a connection to history that is in some ways almost un-American. We're so ferocious about looking to the future and embracing change. But one of the first things I learned when I was a young student there was old is not, there's no negative connotations. Old, as far as I could tell, had very positive connotations. Very anti-American, isn't it? So the British have a kind of a Hitler obsession, and in the popular media there'll be a lot of discussion about the war. There'll be a lot of references to the war, by which they mean World War II. But in terms of hostility to Germany especially, I believe that's faded dramatically.
But those
with generational change, we're referring to our fine young people moving off into the world. I was telling my grandchildren not long ago, you need, people live forever, the world would never make any progress. You really do need for life to come to an end.
Right, and some new blood to enter the
picture.
Absolutely. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show, of course, with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of World Economy, Political Economy and World Business.
Quite right.
Carthage College.
Yes, indeed.
On the other side of the world, you wrote a blog about relations between Japan and the United States and hard work at a new trade agreement, which brings us to one of the most dramatic events afoot right at the moment, namely the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. Explain to our listeners what the significance of this could potentially be, and if you view it as a mostly positive or more negative a thing?
I think it's very positive, indeed essential to continued, basically positive and profitable, even for the average person, growth in international trade. You were talking about the war and referring to the legacy of the war. There's a web of institutions, the European Union, a new transatlantic trade partnership is under discussion, the NATO alliance, the Group of Eight, the Group of 20, these economic partnerships of a very practical sort among major governments, they've tended to be Atlantic-based for the historical reasons you alluded to. There's, over the past several decades especially, driven by necessity, a trend to try to build a similar institutional network in the Pacific. Since the mid-80s, and the U.S. Today as in the past, plays a leading role in this. Since the mid-80s, our total trade volume of exports and imports has been greater with Pacific area nations than with Atlantic area nations. And if we're going to continue to have the kind of remarkably robust growth in international trade that we've had since World War II, it's important that the Pacific framework increasingly reflect the Atlantic area framework. These series of trade negotiations were made possible by the Bretton Woods framework of economic institutions in the UN that, again, were constructed at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, while World War II was still going on in 1944. During the Eisenhower administration, the Dillon Round, Undersecretary of State under Eisenhower, a Wall Street type who became Kennedy's Treasury Secretary, that was the first of the big trade deals, succeeded by the Kennedy Round, again, focused on Atlantic area nations. Tom Clausen's rise at Bank of America was fueled in part by he did one of the first euro-dollar deals, in the 1960s, something that seems a matter of course, the kind of thing that seems a matter of course today, but he used very substantial U.S. dollar deposits in not the U.S., but Europe to finance a major investment deal orchestrated by Bank of America. He made his name by doing very effective, profitable, innovative deals in Europe primarily, but also in Asia. These deals facilitate all kinds of commerce and finance that's essential to the incredible growth we've had since that terrible war.
So
the nutshell answer is yes, it's important, and I think it'll go through
So
the U.S. Congress.
What kind of change would it enact? What's the single most important thing that would change in terms of something opening up or deepening or growing beyond what already is, you know, pretty robust trade situation? What does this agreement do that you see as so essential?
It gives great powers a very powerful practical incentive to work together, and therefore not only increases value, not just for the guys at the top, but for the average person, believe it or not. But it increases prosperity, but it also makes war less likely. Now, mind you, predicting the future is always tough, and professors, I think, are really bad at it. Certainly my record isn't that great. World War I, the old liberal, like British liberal idea that trade would promote peace, World War I dramatically demonstrated that that wasn't the case, because these major combatants were all, they not only traded with one another and had a lot of collective cross-national investment, they married one another in terms of their royal families, but we still had this cataclysmic, horrible war, truly hell on earth, especially for those in uniform.
Yeah.
But in our time, I think there's more grounds to believe it'll make war less likely. It gives us, the Chinese, the Japanese, even more reason to work together, do business together, and avoid the kind of hate-filled ideological conflicts that have become that were so totally destructive with modern technology in the 20th century. That's the most important reason. That's whatever some economists may say about numbers and this and that. It really is a peace-encouraging process.
One of the things that I find intriguing is that this seems to be a matter in which typical political divides fall. Not all of them. And certainly not everybody thinks that this is a good idea, in the same way that not everybody thought NAFTA was a good idea. And there's plenty of people who still think NAFTA was not a good idea.
Yeah.
But on the other hand,
the North American Free Trade Agreement,
right,
that linked the U.S. and Canada very closely with Mexico.
Right. And you know, and there was all kinds of alarm bells raised by you know, a certain faction of the population. But on the other hand, I'm pretty sure it was NAFTA. If not, it was some other similar trade agreement. But I still remember this photograph of, I forget if it was five or six different living presidents standing shoulder to shoulder to speak on behalf in favor of, I can't remember if it was NAFTA or if it was another major trade agreement. But, you know, just the sight of these Democrat and Republican, the current president and the former presidents standing shoulder to shoulder in a gesture of support for this trade agreement. I mean, I just thought that spoke volumes about the way in which this cuts across the party lines, which so often are just impassable chasms when it comes to just about every other issue. Can you explain what that's about?
It shows how a tremendous consensus has developed that we all benefit, whatever the rhetoric. We all benefit from more efficient and more open international trade. It makes war less likely. The rise of Nazism in Germany and fascism elsewhere, the rise of communism before and during the Cold War was facilitated by protectionism in economic terms. There are people who disagree with that, not many among those who are, I think, knowledgeable about the subject. There are some, but this broad consensus, I think, reflects the fact that it's not only stabilizing, but it's more economically efficient. As I've said before in your program, and I think it's important to repeat, it's much easier to talk dispassionately about these issues when you have a job.
Right.
And you and I are both fortunate to be employed, and the vast majority of Americans are. It's a lot different when you're unemployed. But whatever the rhetoric and whatever the media may echo, you are more likely to get a job and stay employed and have a better lifestyle if you avoid protectionism. More directly at your point, the parties have actually flipped in terms of trade positions. Historically, the Republicans were historically the protectionist party. Protect what we used to refer to as infant industry and youthful capitalism in the United States. Abraham Lincoln, seen as a great liberal in ethical and institutional terms, and he was a staunch protectionist. That was the Republican Party until Eisenhower had Robert Taft, who was the initial front runner in 52 to get the nomination, a committed protectionist as well as anti-New Dealer. Things could have evolved quite differently, but Eisenhower changed the, very effectively changed the Republican Party without appearing to be doing so, the great magician. The Democrats, the minority party before the New Deal overall, after the Civil War, the Democrats were on balance more in favor of free trade, a more agrarian party. Farmers from the beginning have had an interest in exporting, given our phenomenal productivity in agriculture. On balance, the Democrats were more the free trade party. Today, protectionism is relatively weak in both parties, but President Obama is having a lot of headaches, and one of them is the fact that protectionist sentiment, as it remains in this country, is more powerful in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party. Clinton, you mentioned NAFTA, Clinton was able to, a tremendous deal maker, especially in hindsight. Clinton was able to develop a bipartisan majority that was more heavily Republican to get NAFTA through the Senate in 94, and he was, of course, a Democratic president.
Well, it'll be interesting to see as this moves forward, and I think most people are predicting that this is going to come to reality, and it will be interesting to see what springs from it.
These kinds of negotiations are very, very complicated, and there's the possibility for a surprise, not only at home but also abroad. John Isham, one of our colleagues in philosophy and related humanities concerns, he and I were talking yesterday about something else related to the center, and he mentioned Clayton Yeider, how impressed he was by Yeider, one of our series of senior visitors we've had at the center in our college, an enormously energetic, phenomenally intelligent individual who was he had some administrative jobs under Nixon. He ran the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, now the CME Group, through the challenging stagflation of the 70s when commodities really boomed globally. And then he was a special trade negotiator for the Uruguay round in the late 80s, and then he was Secretary of Agriculture under George H.W. Bush. A very, very impressive person, very, very fine man, as well as being successful on all fronts. That's why I wanted to get him to come to the college. The Uruguay round, which now goes back to the late 80s, is the last of these multilateral accords that has actually gone to completion, in which the U.S. has played a leading role. It's important to keep that in mind. Succeeded by the Doha round, which has been on hold forever, because it's very hard to get these things through. You need people like Clayton in the variety of countries involved to really drive these to fruition. Doha's focused on agriculture, which despite what I just said in terms of national politics, tends to be very restrictive and protectionist, and Doha has stumbled over agricultural issues between Europe and Africa. And it also has lacked the kind of leadership you need. It really is an extraordinarily difficult kind of negotiation to complete. I think given global growth overall since the Great Recession, we're in good shape for Atlantic as well as Pacific agreements, but you need leadership. You really do.
Speaking of that, you had some fairly scathing criticism of President Obama in a really interesting column you wrote about what seems to have been, at least to some extent, kind of an ill-conceived or certainly poorly executed Middle East summit, Arab summit, in which the major players one hoped would come to the table, in fact, failed to appear. And you open this hard-hitting column by saying the Obama administration tends to confuse rhetoric with accomplishment. And nowhere is that more apparent than in the Middle East with the administration's policy and with this particular incident, which you say is a really good example of their inept calculation of their foreign policy in the Middle East. What went wrong here in your estimation?
It's easy to criticize, and academics like to do it, and in a way we get paid to do it. And it's important to keep that in mind, but I was really quite surprised that the White House pursued this course. There were a lot of challenging issues at hand. Nothing, as far as one could tell, had been prearranged or pre-planned. As I argue in the piece, summits work best when they're basically ceremonial exercises. The aligned troops have done all the tough negotiation. And relating to things like Mr. Yider's performance in the Uruguay round, and the heads of government come together to basically confirm an agreement that's already been reached. There was no real agenda in terms of things that had already been agreed. It appears, as far as one can tell, to be a talk fest, 2 days just concluded in Washington and Camp David. There were supposed to be, I believe, 6 heads of government coming from the Arab states. Only 2 actually came. The King of Saudi Arabia backed out, and others followed his lead. A clear slap in the face to President Obama. It projects an image of weakness and ineffectiveness that nobody needs when you're in a position of executive authority, and when you're president of the United States, it's particularly unfortunate. I mentioned Richard Nixon because, in hindsight, he seems particularly, with his associates, notably Kissinger, effective with the SALT I treaties and then the opening to China, both in 1972, just before the election, and both carried off with extraordinary success. I think that should be the standard by which we measure other leaders in that area. Hmm. Contrary to what I just said, working summits can produce results. The Arab-Israel peace treaty in 1978 was negotiated by Jimmy Carter and brought to success at Camp David. And it remains a phenomenally important legacy for which Carter should get far more credit. But he was a very unusual, intense, as well as highly intelligent, fanatically oriented on details, and it really paid off in that context and tremendously dedicated to getting the job done. Hmm. But that's unusual. Clinton tried a similar thing in 2000, I think, at Camp David. And it was another one of these things that turned out to be a failure.
Hmm. Another tough moment for the Obama administration came with a drone strike in Afghanistan, in which 2 innocent people, including an American citizen, were killed. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it has prompted...
I believe it may have been in the border area with Pakistan.
And of course, that incident has prompted more intense, widespread conversation and debate about the ethical basis of using drones and the kind of questions which we need to be asking ourselves as we move forward from here. First of all, what do you think of the Obama administration's handling of that situation and the fact that, at least from all appearances, President Obama very forthrightly took responsibility for that painful tragedy? I mean, did you at least appreciate that?
Yes, I certainly did, and absolutely. No, I don't think I make the president any kind of consistent target in the weekly op-eds that I produce. I certainly don't intend to, and plenty of other people who do this kind of writing do that. And it's a nice contrast with Nixon's dark side, isn't it?
Right.
I think he should try to keep intelligence matters secret when you can. But in this case, there was a moral issue involved, and there was no reason to maintain secrecy, and he did absolutely the right thing. And I said, I believe I wrote that in the column.
Mm-hmm. So what about drones? What kind of advance in technology does this represent? I think to a lot of us, it feels like an incredibly important advance in technology that transforms everything. But I've read in other places certain analysts who say this is... These really aren't all that different from planes way up in the air dropping bombs on they don't know exactly who. This is just a relatively slight variation on that kind of war waging. I just wonder how you view the use of drones. Is this a dramatic step in a new direction and one we have to be really careful about?
Technologically, no. And Americans, we're very good at technology. We tend to, at least in recent times, exaggerate the importance of technology over more human means of intelligence. I did mention and emphasize in the article that there's nothing immoral in a wartime situation with targeting and killing individuals. And indeed, it's understandable that we tend to be particularly sensitive when it's American citizens. But when you look at the law, our own domestic law as well as international law, such as it is, there are no special citizens in terms of national origins as opposed to other aspects of conflict, whether they're wearing uniforms or not or an established military organization or not. We tend to overemphasize the importance of what technology can do. I believe that was very much the case in the Vietnam War. And more or less in every armed conflict since. There is a danger, therefore, of falling in love with drones, so to speak. The Obama administration has greatly increased the use of drones. I mean greatly, vastly. That's one area in using armed force where the president really seems to be strongly committed to the view that this will help us a lot. Drones... very different from old-fashioned iron bombs, are very, very accurate. This is a trend that predates drones. In the later stages of the Vietnam War, we developed laser-guided, wire-guided, and other kinds of very new, technologically very new munitions that were guaranteed to hit the target. So drones are sort of the latest exposition of that. There are always collateral damage. There is always collateral damage as the American and, I believe, Italian prisoner of the terrorist group, their tragic deaths demonstrate. My understanding from the open media is that after a drone strike to a remarkable degree, Al-Qaeda and other terrorist operatives, but Al-Qaeda remains a principal international group of this kind. They will show up in the area and immediately start to agitate and seek to recruit and emphasize the horrific nature of this terrible American threat. And drones are almost, they're ideal in the role, and it's almost as if they were designed for the role of emphasizing the really frightening aspects of the American supermilitary power. I do believe that means we should not rely on them so much, and we should look for other means of gathering intelligence. If you can take people alive, we do that as well, and some of these activities have reached the open media. We should do that as much as possible. But I do think we're paying a price for the collateral damage, as we have had in other wars when firepower is used in a way that kills people who aren't identified combatants. Hmm. We don't seem to be discussing that enough.
Right.
I'm also concerned about the fact that Pentagon officials, including a high-ranking Defense Department civilian official quite recently, talk in terms of we need to gather more data, we need to collect more information electronically. The overreach of the NSA, a very lazy approach in many ways of monitoring everybody's phone call so that we can pick and choose and look around for things that might give evidence. To me, that's another aspect of the danger of relying on technology alone. You started out talking about our British friends, British intelligence. It's a tough kind of work, and there are lapses in every service. But one reason the British have been so successful for literally hundreds of years, going back to Henry VIII and Elizabeth I and even before, is they really emphasize the human side of dealing with an enemy and work very, very hard related to the balance of power to play people off against each other and exploit human weaknesses as well as human desire and strengths.
Hmm. And there just isn't a machine that does that as well as we do.
Absolutely not, no. And again, one reason the OSS and its successor, the CIA, have been as effective as they have been, German intelligence was terrible during World War II and the First World War, which the British especially exploited with remarkable success, including recruiting Admiral Canaris, the top Nazi intelligence, top German intelligence official, an admiral who was not a Nazi, but he was working more and more for the Allies as the war went on because they'd been able to effectively lure him to our side. And the Soviets were kind of in between with mediocrity. But the human side of intelligence, where a free society has great assets, is we and the British approved, is really our ace in the hole. And I would look for a presidential candidate, since we have an election coming up, who actually is willing to talk about these things and demonstrate some knowledge and some expertise.
By the way, this might be as good a time as any for you to comment on the announcement of a new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah, that's important. Joseph Dunford, an outstanding, they're always outstanding, but an outstanding Marine Corps general, has been nominated by the president. I'm sure he'll sail through as the new chairman. We've had chairman of the Joint Chiefs since the end of World War II, when the Pentagon came into place and the modern military was established and the U.S. Air Force became a separate body. We've only had one other Marine, Peter Pace, during the George W. Bush administration, during his second term. This represents a really significant change and represents the rise of unconventional warriors, an unconventional rise in importance and significance of special operations people of different kinds, I believe, to the top. Stanley McChrystal, an extraordinarily able and admirable military professional, from the U.S. Army, but from Special Forces, rose to the top and was in command in Afghanistan till Rolling Stone, till he and his staff got himself fired by very stupidly talking to Rolling Stone magazine, of all publications. It shows that we're moving in very, very different directions in our military. I'm glad you asked, because it's one of these topics we talk about that is ignored by the mass media. It's not something that's been discussed, but the rise of the Marine Corps, a separate branch, really a separate branch of the military, is quite significant. Alan Enthoven, the number one whiz kid of all the very, very intelligent, intellectual officials who served in the Pentagon with Robert McNamara during an earlier era, I once had, when I was quite young, an opportunity to talk with him, and He corrected me. I mentioned the four services, thinking of the Marines, and he said, there are only three services, and you should know that. Even more than his boss, he saw the world in terms of organization charts.
Yeah.
And unless I missed something, I think the Marines still are organizationally part of the U.S. Navy. But they're really different, as any Marine will tell you, not just in the field. And we're, in many ways, it's good. We're moving away from the organization man view, the guy who puts you down because he's the bureaucrat who knows more of the rules than you do and, you know, points his finger at someone who tells you that, but he actually doesn't do anything.
Yeah,
except
right.
Maybe create disaster in Southeast Asia. That kind of personality is dangerous. And unconventional warriors have other risks, but I think it's very, very positive that these kinds of men and women are getting to the top. Now, Dunford's appointment's very important, and And you don't see this dimension discussed at all. I haven't seen it in the Wall Street Journal. I haven't seen it, you know, in even the sympathetic major media.
Well, we talked about it on the morning show, didn't we?
That's why you're world famous, Greg, and I am too.
Right. Oh, Dr. Artzir, I've enjoyed this hour. I wish we would have had time to touch on the tragic situation in Nepal, and of course we wish the beleaguered citizens of that country well as they rebuild from now two serious earthquakes.
Let's make a point of talking about humanitarian relief next time, because it is important. And Americans past and present do a great deal of crucial work in this area, and we ought to talk about it and know more about it.
Absolutely. I also regret that time prevents us from being able to talk about a milestone that was just passed since your last visit to the morning show, namely the anniversary of America's exit from Vietnam, our retreat from Saigon. And maybe even though we will be well past the 40th anniversary by your next visit, maybe we can just take a few minutes to reflect on that. And, of course, there'll be, I suspect, no shortage of current events to be talking about as well when we rendezvous in June. Professor Art Sear from Carthage College, I do appreciate each and every visit that you pay to the morning show. I'm glad you could be with us today.
Feelings mutual. Have a good weekend.
Thank you so much. Next week's an exciting lineup of morning shows. On Monday, I'm going to be speaking for part of the hour with a very gifted writer from Racine originally, David Curdian, a best-selling author many times over. He is being brought back to Racine by a number of different organizations in Racine, including the Racine Heritage Museum, for a whole series of events in his hometown. And I am excited to be able to speak with him for part of Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, a best-selling novelist by the name of Ralph Peters, who's written some of the most highly regarded historical novels based in the Civil War. His most recent, called Valley of the Shadow. On Wednesday, a conversation with Donald Sull, the co-author of a really interesting book called Simple Rules, How to Thrive in a Complex World. It is the contention of him and his co-author that we live our lives much better, we run our corporations better, even our governments better, when we are guided by simple rules, not too many rules, and rules which allow us significant flexibility to deal with whatever specific issues come our way. It's actually a very, very well-written book, and I'm excited to share that interview on Wednesday. Next Thursday, I'll be speaking with a local psychologist by the name of Lisa Abbott, who has written a new book called Professional Patient, A Memoir of Bipolar Disorder. She is a psychologist, as I said, and also someone who herself has grappled with mental illness. And she has written about that experience in this new book, and I am privileged to be able to speak with her next Thursday. A week from today, we look back to 1965 as I speak with the author of Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America. This is a detailed chronicle about two shocking murders, one of a black man, one of a white man, and those murders helped garner the support needed to bring about the Voting Rights Act. And we'll be talking about that a week from today. You can seek out the Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Cloudy, warm, and breezy this morning. We'll see some sunshine by the afternoon with a high of 73 degrees. It will be cloudy tonight, a 40% chance of showers, a low of 55 degrees. Cloudy and warm tomorrow again with a 40% chance of rain, a high of 79 degrees, a little bit cooler near the lake. Sunday will be cloudy and very warm. Showers and thunderstorms are 60% likely. Sunday's high, again, in the upper 70s. Not quite as warm early next week.